rental, and that's about as far as I think it's ever going to go, personally. But who knows?
KC2SA2, short time mobile.
Yeah, sure, John. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I hate to interrupt because I'm enjoying the conversation, but can I post a ham radio related question?
Sure, I'll put you on the list. I think Wes only has one or two things left on his list of things for tonight, so I'll put you on and you'll go next. Is that okay?
Well, it's up to you guys. And then at my destination, which I won't be hanging out on the radio.
How long time do you got before you think you're going to be off the radio?
Just a few minutes here.
Okay, let him go.
Okay, John, you're on. What's the question or topic for tonight?
Thank you, Wes. Well, you know what's been on my mind? I'll think about preselectors and radios. How much protection is that really offering in my very busy ham shack? So I'm keying up on a 50 that is, you know, just 10 feet from some other antennas, and that's on a different band. You know, is that really safe? How much am I beating up the radios? Is the preselector offering the protection? You know, what's going on for 2 meters and such?
Okay, you're kind of overdriving the connection with the repeater and occasionally falling out of it. So if you can cut the gain on the microphone, that would probably make things easier.
Good to know. I'm sorry. Yeah, I just replaced the receiver, so I finally have a new receiver. But I haven't had a lot of time to get feedback on the audio quality. It seemed okay when I did the audio test, but apparently it needs a little more tweaking. My question is, how much of the preselectors, what is the protection scenario? Same site, I've got repeaters and radios, and, you know, how dangerous is 50 watts of one radio, let's say a 2 meter, and I've got a 220 right there, and also a DMR radio. Is the preselector the primary protection? Why doesn't 440 overload 144 more than it does? Is it the preselector doing that? What's going on there?
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's going to come down to the inevitable. It's complicated, and it depends upon the electrical engineer. There's a whole bunch of factors going on. If you're transmitting on one frequency, and chances are the other radio's antenna is not highly selective for that frequency, so you're going to get a significant amount of mismatch loss. It's going to operate as a non-resonant antenna. There'll be a lot of reflection. There'll be a lot of attenuation loss. So, I mean, there might be cases where you happen to have a two-band antenna on two radios, and one you're operating UHF and one VHF. So that isn't the important thing. Also, the important thing is the location of all your antennas, because that's where it's picking up most of the electromagnetic energy. If you got it in the near field, which I wouldn't recommend, then you might have some problems no matter what. You want things in the far field, if at all possible, which isn't that difficult, certainly with UHF and VHF. And so you got a combination of the distance between the antennas, the loss of the antenna for that frequency, the loss going down the transmission line, and then you get the front end, where there's some degree of rejection and some degree of overpowered, circuitry that kind of hairpins it out if it gets too strong. So depending upon who designed it and what decade it was, It's not that easy to short out the front ends of radios these days, thankfully, but if you're determined to do it, you can.
Sure, understood. All good stuff. But to what degree does the pre-selector play in that game, and how many radios actually had that? Is that old technology? Is it new technology? Is it just HF technology? Go ahead.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, there are radios that have separate circuits for UHF and VHF, and so you know, they all run parallel to each other. So some of them, the old ones certainly had the preselectors. They have tuned circuits, and that was the nature of front ends. And to this day, you still get conversations that Balfungs have no are fully open. You can screw things up way off frequency, because the front end of a Balfung is not really designed to select out of a frequency. But most modern-day engineered radios usually have well-designed front ends that take care of it in most cases. So again, it's more a factor of what decade you bought your radio and how anal retentive your electrical engineers have been. Those that still have pre-selectors, obviously, you should use them because they're belt, but other engineers use suspenders.
Yeah, real good. And I imagine with strip line and microstrip technology, some of the filtering perhaps has done that. Always learn all my stuff. Being so close together and what's going to happen over long-term exposure. A part of fortunately one's vertical and the other one's horizontal. I always make sure I'm at least on a different band, when I tee up on band, but then of course there's the VHF stuff as well, and that's even more numerous. EC2, GSKC2, HO mobile.
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, the bottom line, try to keep your antennas out of the near field and try not to go on the same band with two radios if you can get away with, without doing it. It's kind of difficult if you're doing UHF-VHF because you're either UHF-VHFing. But HF, you should better safe than sorry. I don't think burning out the front end is something that happens gradually. I think it's more of a kind of immediate assault upon the circuitry. So I don't think it degrades operation over the long haul. I think it's just the more you tend to use the same band with antennas that are not that far apart from each other, the more you kind of risk a peak power that's just kind of destroying your front end. But, again, as long as you understand what's going on and try, and we all kind of sometimes turn zombie, and we just kind of turn on the switch without thinking. But, if you design and you coordinate everything reasonably well, nowadays I think it's not as common as it was many, many years ago.
I think you had a commenter in there, but I'll also say, sometimes you're even, same switches, so I worry about bleed over there. But I think there's another commenter there.
Okay, someone want to make a comment, please? Nothing heard. I mean, long, long time ago, I should have known better, but I discovered that if you try and use switches that are not rated for high frequency, the concept of it being a switch is very imaginative. It's not. If you get a HF switch and you plug in some UHF and VHF stuff, it'll leak like a sieve.
Yeah, also understood, and, you know, much to the detriment of art, I've written that I need to stay away from the cheaper switches, the Alpha Deltas, you know. And the switch is not cheap, you know, but at least they have the lightning protection and the grounding position, which we have a big storm that just came through and grounded out everything I could and even still worry about such things. But okay, real good. I'm probably getting noisy, and I don't want to take up all the time. Hope you can get back to Wes. And Wes, thank you for cut in. I'm going to be getting out of range real quick. EC2GS and the rest of the gang.
AC2GS
from KC2, that's the chair, back to control.
AC2GS.
Jeff, you wanted to say something?
KC2PL, I have a query. The station was breaking up and dropped a couple times. And he said that the Alpha Delta something something, he was talking about bad switches, and then he said Alpha Delta, but a lot of the transmission was missing, so the question remains for the listening audience whether he thought Alpha Deltas were bad or good.
Well,
I like them. I like them. They're good. They're good switches.
Okay, John has spoken. He likes them. I would assume that was the case because he was talking, he was explaining that they're a little bit on the expensive side, which they are, but they have a built-in grounding and safety feature for lightning and such. So, yeah, they're not the cheapest present-day switches out there. There are significantly cheaper ones. I have just about every switch that was manufactured in the last 15, 20 years. So I've kind of used them off and on. I've had 4-in-1, I have a 3-in-1, I have a 2-in-1, all kinds of interesting switches. But, yeah, so those are very well high-quality stuff.
AC2PL, that's what I thought he was saying, but, again, he dropped out when he said he was talking about poor quality. He said Alpha Delta immediately after. That's all I heard, and I was just thinking that anyone listening, I mean, I'm looking at an Alpha Delta in my shack right now, which manages all my HF, so I was teetering on the edge of wondering. But no, obviously, it's those are good switches, and the grounding is the best feature QSL AC to go back to them.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the drive level was a little too high, and he just kind of jumps right out of the repeater. But you know, hopefully next week he'll kind of readjust the output level so it won't kind of overdrive the repeater next time.
Sometimes I'm amazed how far this little machine reaches in elevation and even distance. But anyway, I've got two, there's four-way Alpha Deltas, and they are excellent for my UHF and VHF stuff. And I've got two spinner baseball switches that I got on eBay. And spinner says they made them custom for a customer, but they were able to send me a little bit of information about it anyway. 73, all the best. KC2SHO, Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Okay, 73, John. Always a pleasure. Thanks for participating. Wes, it's back to you.
Okay, I have just subject, so it's not going to take long. One of them is, how can the universe expand faster than the speed of light? So, we know that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. But what that actually means in terms of the universe after the Big Bang, it looks like it is calculable in the sense of probability. So,
when we may think that if we know that speed of light is the maximum it could go, then we can just measure the time from the Big Bang times the speed in all directions to find out the size of the universe. And I got the answer from Dr. Roy, and I think it's interesting, Dr. Roy.
Okay, you can't really do that, Wesley, because that's the observable universe. The observable universe is a subset of the total universe. So, and the problem, as I emailed you, is unfortunately semantics once again, which I really hate arguing semantics. The limitations of causality in space-time is the speed of light in a vacuum. So it's a characteristic not really of, say, light or gravity, but a characteristic of space-time itself. Space-time, the very fabric of space-time cannot propagate any kind of a causality at a rate faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. The problem is, what the heck is the rest of the universe that isn't space-time? Because if you think about it, it makes no sense whatsoever. The rest of the universe, whatever the hell that means, would have no space nor time. How does something exist out of time and out of space? So theoretically, if you were able to somehow conjure something up that has kind of pseudo-space and pseudo-time, it may not have the same limitations. The problem with the universe is said to be expanding, but it's also said to be infinite. And then you have problems because how can an infinite thing expand? You know, when you have something that's an infinite volume, how do you double it? It's still an infinite volume. So the way around that is that it's not really expanding. What's happening is the scale of the universe is increasing. So all the little bits of particles, photons, planets, stars, all kinds of neutron stars, black holes, are spreading farther because the distance between them is getting longer because the scale factor of just space-time in the universe is increasing somehow, which is kind of difficult to wrap your head around, any of that. So the perception, if you looked at the edge of the universe, and if you were an immortal being, as time went on, you would the periphery that you could see today would be gone in a million years because it would travel beyond the light cone, which means that it would seem to us as though it was traveling faster than the speed of light, but you can't use that phrase because the expansion of the universe or the scale of the universe is not a velocity. It's something else that looks a lot to us like velocity, but it's something else. So as far as the English language is concerned, you can't kind of make a case for anything that travels faster than the speed of light, again, because the expansion of the universe is not a velocity, so it's a meaningless concept of comparing it to the speed of light, which is a velocity. I hope I haven't confused everyone.
No, you didn't confuse me. Of course, I'm going to pick up that point that I sent to you in response to your email. So we have a PhD, Paul M. Schutter, that works as an astrophysicist in Stony Brook at Latvian Institute. So we're talking about a semantic and we're talking about factors that take into consideration. It looks like he didn't take any other factor but observable universe to consideration as something that exists. And his quote is, "It comes out of relativity theory core innovation that There is no such thing as a place outside space-time. No external or absolute standard to judge by. By that he denies speed of light, and I asked Dr. Roy true or false, and he gave me a very interesting answer. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Well, again, it goes back to what I just previously said. The problem is that the universe appears, use that as a big word, appears to be spreading out faster than the speed of light. But it's not undergoing, strictly speaking, a velocity. A velocity is a vector. This is not a vector. This is a scale factor. So you can't compare a vector with a scale factor. So by that nature, the universe is not expanding faster than the speed of light. It's not expanding at any velocity. It's scaling. So thanks for that, but what do I do with it? And you don't do much with it, because again, if you're looking there at the periphery edge of the universe, as far as we can see, the edges are going to disappear over time. So even though a scale factor is not the same as the velocity, it's going to appear as though the edges of the universe have escaped our light cone. And you would kind of perceive that as having needed to go faster than the speed of light to get out of our light cone. If it was at the speed of light or below, it would maintain the same light cone, and you would see the periphery for the rest of eternity. But you won't. As time goes on, we're going to see less and less of the universe as the edges pass away from our light cone, and we won't be able to observe it anymore.
Thank you, Dr. Roy. I have a question to Paul. Paul, would you mind to respond to the subject matter?
I am here.
Yeah, my question was, would you mind to respond to the subject matter?
No problem, Wesley. Don't know what the subject matter is yet, but sounds good to me. We'll be here. WS2N.
So it looks like you didn't listen to the conversation. Dr. Roy, would you mind to, in a few words, to relate it to Paul?
Okay, I thought he was going to bring up another topic, Roy.
No, that's the topic. The topic is the expanding universe. Let's do
it. Okay, no, yeah, I heard Roy's answer. And, you know, it, as far as I know, it's expanding, and they proved that with the supernovas that they look at in the different galaxies. So they know it's not only expanding, but it's accelerating. And with no end in sight, you know. And then they expect that the future, everything to be expanding with not only the molecules, but the atoms and whatever the atoms are made of will also start separating. And I think they call that the big chill. So, you know, that's what we're heading for. And there won't be anybody around to make those evaluations, though. Back to you, Wesley. WS1.
They call that the heat death, which is actually the death of heat.
Yeah, but the question, we were talking about how can the universe expand faster than the speed of light, and Dr. Roy actually made quite a comment on it. Paul, pick up.
You mean faster than the speed of light? Well, even when it, after the Big Bang, the universe expanded relatively to each other, faster than the speed of light. but, you know, that wasn't really measurable because, you know, you didn't have atoms and you didn't have what you have today. You know, the universe definitely expanded faster than the speed of light right after the Big Bang. So, as far as I'm concerned, that's already happened.
HE2RY, good evening.
Hello, David. Do you have something to add to this particular discussion?
Yes, I wanted to say that the universe is mostly empty space.
Yeah, we kind of had that discussion last Sunday. Joe checked in, and he was driving with a woman, and she had a couple of interesting questions, and one of it was Fermi's problem that, you know, why haven't we bumped into a lot of green little men who know a lot more about technology than us? And the answer that I tried to give her was that there's a big distance between everything and everything else, so it's very difficult to get anywhere. And yes, the average, I think the average density of the universe is something like each cubic meter has approximately five atoms, if you take the average.
You know, other people would say that the universe is 100% consciousness.
Well, you can say anything that you want. The problem is that consciousness, unfortunately, is a very vague thing. And, you know, you could say a rock is conscious, but I don't really think so. But, you know, I mean, people are free to think what they want to think. And neurophysiology has a lot more to understand how brains work, how thought work, and how consciousness works.
Well, you know, you can use consciousness to describe consciousness.
AC2GF, that would be kind of redundant, you know, because if you kind of say that everything is conscious, you know, then it kind of makes everything meaningless, because if everything is something and nothing isn't it, then that's just everything. But you know, to describe exactly why a rock is conscious, you know, that would kind of, it's not something I could actually sit down and do. Maybe you could, but I can't. I mean, you could make a case for living things being conscious, but again, you have to really be able to objectively define what consciousness truly is, which I don't think has been quite done yet, and may not get done for many, many years to come. And then, using that definition, explain why each and everything in the universe is conscious. There's a lot of things in the universe, and my guess is that a whole bunch of it wouldn't quite qualify as conscious. But what do I know?
Well, maybe this is the right question. The question is, can scientists, their work really hard, they get paid for their work, you know, and they have to produce a product for their clients, you know, and I guess those products would have to be theory, scientific theory, you know. My question is, you know, would this be something that would motivate them to think of whatever they could, you know, to please the clients, whether it is useful or not?
Again, it sort of depends on the individual. Some scientists are just interested in their own subjects, and if they don't have a sponsor who's interested, they'll either find another sponsor or they'll do it on the cheap privately. And on the other end of the extreme, there's occasionally, unfortunately, fraudulent scientists who will fake anything that you ask them to do if the paycheck is big enough and the award is big enough. So, again, it sort of depends on the scientist. But, you know, consciousness is again, it's not something that every scientist is working on, you know. Neurophysiologists and philosophers, for the most part. And have they gotten anywhere so far? Not as far as I've been able to read. They have some interesting theories and ideas and proposals. People who enjoyed as Isaac Asimov's Foundation stories, the story ended with a planet, I believe they called it Gaia. And it was a live planet. The consciousness of the human beings was kind of merged with everything else on Gaia, which is an interesting premise for a science fiction story. But again, what that actually means and how you actually do that, no one has the faintest idea.
Yeah, I think people need to get more of what they really want for the discussion, you know? Anyway, I had a couple of questions to ask you maybe later, and thank you for chatting up, KG2RY.
You're welcome, David. Yeah, we can touch on your questions when Wes is done. Wes, you want to continue on this subject in any way, shape, or form, or you want to move on to the next one?
Yeah, I have the last one. So the last one is entropy and Bose and Zane condensate. So can we try it? and its relation to superconductivity, superaccurate clock, the quantum entanglement in terms of quantum computing, measurement and sensing technology, detecting gravitational waves, navigation, and improving MRI. That MRI is NMR. NMR. Atom, lasers, cooling. Yeah, that's an interesting subject. You could say a few words about atom laser cooling. So, we never be able to reach the speed of light, and we never be able to reach the temperature that is close to 0 degrees, absolute zero. So laser cooling usually is associated with heating materials or laser cutting. So how could the laser be cooling? And back to your microphone about the Bose Einstein condensate. Why that is a fifth state of matter, we could say it. And I was that not far ago discovered. Most of the discovery were in the beginning of the 20th century. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
AC2GS. Well, we kind of talked about this either last week or the week before. I'll go over it again. The point is that theoretically, a fourth, there's liquid, solid, gas, and plasma. So, back, I think, in the 1920s, a Indian physicist by the name of Bose, who gave the boson its name, by the way, wrote a paper and sent it to Albert Einstein, who got very excited, and the two of them presented a paper about the so-called Bose-Einstein condensate. The concept being that as you take a bunch of neutral atoms to a lower and lower temperature, we're talking about nanokelvin, each individual atom's wavelength lengthens and ultimately kind of coalesces into one big wavelength, and effectively that cluster of super cold atoms behave as a single quantum particle. so that they experience, although it could be something like 20 atoms, they experience quantum effects, they experience entanglement, superfluidity, superconducting. All these nice little things kind of pop into their existence when the condensate becomes a single a quantum mechanical particle, if you will. So that's a Bose-Einstein condensate. It took many years. It took 50 years from Bose's paper to being able to actually do it in a lab. But since then, they've done it all over the place. They've even done it in the space station. So it's a thing, like I said. The trick, let me drop for a second. Okay, the trick that a lot of people don't really kind of get, how do you use a laser to cool something down? You have to, again, understand temperature is the average kinetic energy of a bunch of atoms or molecules. So you have a small number, a cloud of atoms that are kind of sitting there in a vessel. You put six lasers in the different axes, and you design them so that the atoms will not absorb the laser if it's not moving, because of the nature of those bonds, that they simply won't. It's the wrong energy level. But if the atom is traveling towards the laser, it's going a little faster, the Doppler effect is going to shift what the laser's frequency is perceived of by the atom, and at that point, it's able to absorb the energy, and the momentum makes it go opposite the laser. So you've slowed down the kinetic energy of the atom in that axis. You have six of them doing it all the time, and then you have a magnetic field that hopefully can kind of keep them from spreading out. And so by doing that, you lower the temperature down to nanokelvins, very, very close to absolute zero. You can't be at absolute zero because quantum mechanics does not allow it. But you can come precariously close to absolute zero. And at that point, you have a Bose-Einstein condensate, and you can play with the characteristics of this new form of matter, this new state of matter, for all the things that you mentioned. For entanglement, entanglement leads to quantum computers, and quantum transportation, and all the other little things that you mentioned. So this is why everyone is so excited about Bose-Einstein condensates.
Thank you very much for that. We could make some condensed condensed wording from what you said. We have a certain amount of people in the United States, and right now we have election, and let's say if we lower the temperature to minus 273.15 Celsius, which is minus 459.67 Fahrenheit, but close to it. All of these people, if they are still alive, if we say theoretically that matter could survive it, then they would act the same. They would not act like 320 million of Americans. They would act like one. So if that one says no to Trump, then no to Trump. That's it. Okay. Let me jump. Okay. As far as the laser cooling, I understood that it relies on the change in momentum when an object such as an atom absorbs or re-emits a photon, that particle of light. So if the laser light illuminates the photons and atoms from all directions, and the laser frequency is or cooled. So my own chamber that I have made up, I could go to, now with helium, could go to a 4K, 4 degrees of Kelvin, but I can go to 4 of Kelvin, 4 is guaranteed. And from that point, I have 2 degrees, which is difficult to go with using any kind of to go to close to 0. And then I'm going to have any matter reacting because of its wave-like behavior. Right or wrong? And to
exchange. AC2GS. Unfortunately, there's someone else doing something, you know, on the repeater. So I didn't make out everything that you said. You might have been alluding to superfluidity, which is another very interesting characteristic of something that's super cooled, where there is no viscosity. You know, all liquids that we're aware of have viscosity, in the same way that all conductors that we used to be familiar with had some inherent resistance. But at very low temperatures, you can have a conductor that has no resistance. And at superfluidity levels for different materials, you have no viscosity. So you have interesting things like a superfluidic hydrogen or helium. Just kind of goes against gravity. It goes out of the cup, over the lip, and out to the ground type of stuff. So I'm assuming that you were talking about superfluidity, but I could be wrong in that assumption.
Okay, but right now I increased the power to 40 watts. I assume that I'm going much better.
Well, as long as there's no one in the background playing, you're sounding great.
With increased power, I believe 5 watts and 40 watts is quite a difference. I was talking about the laser cooling, and I was talking about the understanding of laser cooling, where the laser light illuminates a warm crowd of atoms from all directions, and the laser frequency is tuned below the atomic resonance, so the atoms are cooled. And I was talking about my own chamber that I have. Old chamber that I have that goes to 4 Kelvin by manufacturer standard, but it goes to 2 Kelvin. So I have a 2 Kelvin to go to close to 0, and that could be done by any kind of cooling technique that allows to do that. But anyhow, I was talking about a behavior of the matter that is no longer acting as individual atoms, but it's acting as one atom. So, and I compare that to the population of the United States, that if we use the analogy, we have 220 million of Americans plus about 20 million of illegals in this country. If we could create the same conditions and those individuals would survive, then they would act as one. Everybody say no to Trump, it's no to Trump, because they act based on its wave-like structure. Back to you.
Well, not really. They would react quantum mechanically identically. There's a lot of limitations of ways of reacting. At near zero absolute temperature, their muscles wouldn't move. Nothing gross and macroscopic would move or do anything. on a quantum level, excitation levels of electrons and such, you might get some movement. But otherwise, they would probably be frozen statues as far as you would be concerned.
I understand. It was easy to use a certain analogy. That's why I went to do different forms of analogy to explain that. I never tried laser cooling, nor I have enough of knowledge to. I mean, not the knowledge. Everything could be done. It's just a matter of expenses to the end and forward. So most of us, instead of doing experiments, we read about the experiments done by other guys, and we look at the credentials of those individuals who make those papers that we can read. Back to you, Dr. Roy, and thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Wesley. Also, depending upon how much you want to argue semantics, you could also say that there are other forms of states of matter. You could kind of say a neutron star, which is kind of just made out of neutrons, is another form of matter. A gluon, a field where it's so much energy in the environment that everything has fallen apart, and all the protons and neutrons are now quarks and gluons. Just kind of immersed in a fluidic type of sea at intensely high energies. You know, we're talking about a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. So there are other possible things that you could call states of matter for anyone out there who wants to look things up.
Actually, I have one question for you because I'm not sure if you would be able to answer it. Both information. I found information is used to improve MRI or NMR, whichever way you like it. And the question is how. Back to you.
Yeah, I saw that notation. Unfortunately, the YouTubes you sent me were not terribly good at explaining anything. They just threw stuff out and you had to kind of figure it out on your own. I don't know exactly what they're alluding to that would improve their understanding on how magnetic resonance imaging works on a theoretical basis, but I assume that's what they were alluding to.
Okay, thank you very much, Judy. Let's see.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS, and next on our list is David. What do you got for us tonight, David?
Well, hello there. I just want to ask you, I have this guitar, and it has nylon strings, and installed in the bridge of a guitar is a piezo pickup. On my steel string guitars, there's always magnetic pickups. They say sometimes they combine them. I don't think any of my guitars have a combination of piezo and magnetic. What do you know about this?
Okay, well, I mean, you could even go back to the average good old turntable. You had piezoelectric cartridges, and you had magnetic cartridges. For the most part, people prefer the magnetic cartridges. I think the voltage output was lower, but the fidelity and other qualities was a little bit better. So you have piezoelectricity, which is basically that any kind of bending or distorting a crystal will induce an electric voltage potential difference, which can be picked up on and amplified electronically and can be used to reproduce the guitar music. The other possibility is, if you go back to the turntable, but you could kind of use it for guitars as well, is that you have the arm and it's vibrating on the vinyl, and it has a small magnet attached to one end of it, and it has coils of wire encircling it. And as the magnet is moving around in three-dimensional space from the grooves, it is producing a small current in the coils. The coils are then amplified to a greater extent, and you have a high-fidelity sound reproduction. So it's just a matter of whether you want to use a crystal to record vibrations, kinetic energy, distortions, or if you have something that's either ferromagnetic or you know, and you have them near an electric field coil, and that its motion generates electromagnetic field and produces current that can be also used to power a amplification system and reproduce the music from the instrument.
Well, tell me, what do you know about this? The guitar has a piezo pickup on it. The strings are nylon strings. The vibrations go throughout the body of the guitar into the bridge of the guitar where the strings are attached. And when I plug it into one acoustic amplifier, I get some feedback. I get some feedback from that. Then what I do is I take the preamplifier, I plug the guitar into a preamplifier. From the preamplifier, I plug it into the amplifier. And then what I do is I reduce the low end and the medium, the first medium. It has a four level EQ. So the first one low, second one medium low, and the rest I leave alone. And I guess maybe I have to raise the volume a little bit.
Okay, well, as I said before, the piezoelectric transducer picks up any kind of vibration that it feels. Anything that disrupts the crystal lattice structure is going to induce a voltage. Now, when you're playing the instrument, that's producing vibrations, and that's going to produce a voltage potential. But if you output the voltage potential to an amplifier, and then the amplifier to a speaker, and then the speakers are near enough to the guitar, you're producing a kind of second-order bunch of vibrations. Your guitar is acting as a receiver for acoustic waves. And your piezoelectric transducer doesn't know what came from your guitar or what's going to your guitar. It's the same thing to itself, and so it will do the same thing with the echo, with the output, audio output from your amplifier and speaker, and turn it into more sound, and then you get the squeal from the feedback because there's inherently a resonance that kind of builds up on one particular frequency. So by adjusting the equalization of the amplifier, you're dulling the resonant frequencies and lessening the feedback going on.
QSL. Yeah, I'm aware of that. What to say, this amplifier, I don't know what the settings are for the microphone port or the guitar port. But when I plug the guitar into the microphone port, there is no feedback. You know, I have another amplifier that I set up, and I plug it right into that amplifier. Crystal clear sound and no feedback. You know, how can amplifiers vary? Maybe there's something wrong with the first amplifier.
Not necessarily. The guy who designed your amplifier probably knows that if you're going to use a microphone, it's supposed to operate at voice frequencies. So it probably has a built-in filter that strips out the ultra-low frequencies because people don't really need them to converse with each other. So it's just the equalization circuits are probably different for the two inputs, whether it's the guitar input, because it could be any frequency, so it probably has no frequency attenuation, versus the microphone, which is more contoured for human voice.
Would you say that the microphone would be a magnetic device, and the amplifier set up, the microphone port, they take a magnetic device as opposed to guitar, which could be anything?
No, I don't think that that's the situation at this point, at least. It's just all it knows is it's looking for a voltage differential and then putting that through the filtration system, blocking some ultra-low frequencies, ultra-high frequencies, so that you don't get harmonics and other such things. So I don't think that that's what's going on with the microphone, because you could use a dynamic microphone, you could use a condenser microphone. Theoretically, you could use a piezoelectric element for a microphone. The old-fashioned telephones that were around when we were babies were carbon granules. So they're just looking for a difference in voltage potential.
QSL, I guess on that amplifier, I plugged the guitar into the microphone port and the microphone into the guitar port and then slowly increased the levels. You know, there's another amplifier, it's much bigger, much more powerful, and I don't remember what they said, what they called it, but there was some kind of special filter, for this kind of problem, maybe some other kinds of problems, special filters, but then they say that the result or the sound that you get is, it's clear, but, it doesn't have a distortion that a lot of people want.
Well, the microphone, there's probably no microphone that's 100% perfect at reproducing all the frequencies at the given output that they were originally introduced. So, you optimize as best you can. You use a mechanical construction that will hopefully reproduce as much as you can, and you make up the difference with electrical circuits that adjust the equalization accordingly. So, there are all kinds of different microphones out there. You can buy a microphone from China for about $2-3. Although a broadcast radio microphone from Germany, they don't even look shameful when they ask you $3,000 for that one. So, they come in all shapes and sizes and monetary values.
QSL, Roy. Yeah, the microphone I have is a magnetic microphone. I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's actually a lavalier mic attached to a metal, frame. You just put it on your head, and it works pretty good. Anyway, thank you very much for this conversation. Tell me something. Before I turn on my radio to talk on this TechNet, I made a contact with a de-expedition. It was Fernando de Norena. Fernando de Norena. Do you know where that is?
Nope, I do not.
It's a small island off the coast of Brazil. It's about 4,000 miles from New York City.
Oh, okay. There are a lot of islands on this world. Every so often, I end up having to watch a YouTube of some crypto bro who made a lot of money and wants to buy himself an island and turn it into his own private nation where there's no government and other weird things like that. So there's lots of islands out there. A lot of them are inhabited. A lot of them aren't.
Well, this station, they were totally in the clear. And people were calling and he was picking